Burası Ahval. Doğru haberciliğin ve özgür yorumların odak noktası. Podcast yayınımıza hoş geldiniz.
Hello and welcome to Ahval Forum. My guest today is from Paris, Professor Hamit Bozaslan, lecturer at School of Advanced Studies in Social Sciences. In short, EHES, one of the prominent schools in France. Welcome, Hamit.
Thank you.
Today we are going to talk, as usual, about the current affairs in Turkey, where it's heading, as we usually do with you. And we'll start, of course, since we spoke last time, some unexpected developments took place. One being the turmoil in Caucasus and Turkey's involvement in the Karabakh conflict. And also lately, the elections in northern Cyprus. But in general, the tension in eastern Mediterranean is continuing. Escalation is ongoing. And also there is some sort of a de facto deadlock with the European Union, between European Union and Ankara. Where are we at, in your view, with the Turkish foreign policy and where it's heading at?
I think that we should bear in mind two points. The first one, and Erdogan has reminded it recently. Erdogan estimates that the moment of historical revenge over the past is arriving, and that Turkey is finally ready to deliver struggle against all foreign powers, Europe, United States, but if necessary also Russia. Mm-hmm. So I think that this idea that the Turks has a historical mission, that this historical mission has been interrupted by the westernization of the 19th century and after by the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire, is a clear idea for Erdogan, and the Turkishness has to take its revenge and re-emerge as the main dominant power in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Not exclusively in the Middle
Turkishness.
East. Turkishness defined by Islam.
Defined by Islam.
Yes, because for Erdogan, and that's a long-going tradition actually, Islam has to be defined by Turkishness, and Turkishness has to be defined by Islam.
So we are talking about a merger, historic merger.
A historical merger, but for Erdogan, the Turkishness has a double mission, historical mission. The first mission is to dominate the world, and he reminds it in many of his speeches. And the second mission is to protect Islam. He cannot understand or imagine that Islam can exist without the protection brought by the Turkish nation as such. And the second point, I think that we have to be quite aware of this point too. We observe a kind of hubris in Turkish foreign policy. And hubris, as you know, was something quite frightening in the old Greece and Greek traditions or culture. Hubris means that a leader almost considers himself as God and try to elevate his position to the position of the gods as Zeus. And the Greek, the ancient Greeks were very afraid of this this temptation of hubris, and they underlined again and again the necessity of having a nomos to counterbalance hubris. When you take the political philosophy like Hannah Arendt underlines also the necessity of limiting hubris, because if a hubris became an autonomous strategy in this case, it will not only destroy what it founds around itself, but it will at the end destroy itself too. Mm-hmm. What happened in the Nazi Germany or in Italian Mussolini Italy was a consequence of partly at least was a consequence of hubris for Hannah Arendt. Mm-hmm. And today I think that we really observe a feeling of a symptom of hubris in the Turkish internal and external policies. When you take the economic situation in Turkey, the economic situation is absolutely dramatic, and it will probably worsen, and everyone is aware that the economic situation will not improve in the coming months. The COVID-19 crisis is a very heavy crisis, and everyone agrees with that. And you add them to this crisis, the crisis in Syria, the crisis in the Eastern Mediterranean, the crisis in Libya, the crisis definitely in the Caucasus, and maybe tomorrow elsewhere, like in Bosnia or in Macedonia. So where this hubris will stop, and at the end, what will be the cost of this hubris, of course, we do not know, but it is a very, very, very dangerous path.
Is it, when you speak about hubris, are we talking about disproportionate confidence in the capabilities and intentions?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And in destruction of check and balances, we are talking about ignoring totally the limitations that you might have. Mm-hmm. And it means that you take one step, and in this step, step you are successful. A second one, you are successful because no one has stopped you. You try to take a third step, and you are successful because no one stops you, until a moment where you don't have any more, any kind of check and balances, any kind of capacity of interrogating your own capabilities. Mm.
So I had in mind more about the military capabilities, because the involvement, for example, apart from Syria and Libya, now what we see exposed in Caucasus, in the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict, usage of drones, extensive usage of drones. And if some sources are correct, there are, as we speak, around 600 Turkish Armed Forces servicemen in the area. So a lot of commentators, analysts, may have misread the capabilities of Turkey, saying that declining economy would have slowed down Turkey's irredentist moves. But it's not happening. It is continuing as before.
It is continuing. I think that this is something quite predictable, actually. Mm-hmm. You have that also in Iran, in the Iranian case. You have that also in the Russian case. I think that a declining or a destroyed economy does not mean necessarily that a state or a regime will necessarily lose its capacity, its military capacity. Mm. But it's also seen that in the Nagorno-Karabakh, in spite of so heavily mobilized forces, for a while being at least, there is no conclusive evidence that the Blitzkrieg will take place. Mm. Blitzkrieg did not succeed. And at the end, you have against you partly Russia, the United States, maybe after the Biden elections, if he wins the elections, and the Europe, the relations with Europe are quite quite conflictful. So Turkey has military capabilities, and I think that the Erdoganism has definitely increased these capabilities, but at the same time, you cannot multiply your military capabilities and the number of your enemies. At one point, you have to reduce the number of your enemies, and you cannot say that you will be able to face Europe, the United States, and Russia at the same time. Mm-hmm. You can create alliances with one of them against the other, etc. You might be in balance, but when you clearly define your strategy as potentially conflictful with everyone, at that point you are in hubris.
You are in hubris. Problematic hubris.
Problematic hubris.
A hubris that leads to
the case of Iran. Iran has a much clever strategy. Iran has also a military capability, has also military capabilities, but Iran has a very clear line, and this line is a hegemonic line in the Middle East. And in this hegemonic line, a strategy in the Middle East, there is a kind of alliances with Russia and with China. Mm-hmm. And it is very, very, very unlikely to see tomorrow that Iran provokes any kind of major conflict with Russia or with China. Mm-hmm. And here you can say there is a clear hegemonic projection. Mm. But in the case of Turkey, you don't see this clear hegemonic projection, because this projection means that you have to isolate all your allies and all your foes at the same time, and that potentially everyone is your enemy and that you don't have any kind of friend. Well,
except Qatar, maybe.
Yeah, in Turkey, in any case. Even the Kemalist ideology was the Turks have no other friends than the Turks themselves, etc. So that kind of
motto,
mindset, and add to that, well, the economic situation is still an important factor. For while being Europe has taken no sanction against Turkey. And I think that my reading, at least, is that Europe wants to avoid to take any kind of sanctions against the Erdogan regime. But at one point, it will be obliged to do that.
That's what I was wondering about, and I was going to just ask you about this. So far, there have been some clash points or escalation that saw some ending in a way for a reckoning point. And each and every time this escalation took place, we saw that partly in Libya, but especially in Eastern Mediterranean, lately, for example, when Oruç Reis again started sailing towards, and it's still there, off Castellorizo Meis Island, the estimation was from outside that, okay, now that European Union gave time for Turkey. This time, it must have perhaps crossed the red line of the European Union, and it will start talking in a much rougher language. But it didn't happen, despite the fact that the French Paris was quite clear already from the very beginning. And also, in addition to that, Hamid, in Caucasus, now it's been like more than 2 weeks of the conflict, the Turkish military involvement, interference is quite clear, but the Russians are also quite reluctant. So overall, how do you read that? Hesitation about? Russian hesitation as well.
I think that you can explain a lot. You can explain the hesitation with a lot of reasons, by a lot of reasons. Concerning European Union, I think that European Union does not exist as a political entity, and that's something quite impressive to see that the first economic power in the world politically does not has no weight at all. And I think that the Merkel administration particularly tries still to negotiate with Erdogan and use diplomatic tools until the moment that these diplomatic tools will not be any more of any kind of relevance. But I think that the democracies, they are not strong. The democracies, they can capitulate to the anti-democracies. And we observe for while being this. Concerning Russia, I think that in the Russian case, Russia has a strategy going back, imperial strategy, going back to the 19th century. And within the framework of this strategy, actually no conflict has to be resolved. All the conflicts must remain
open.
So that the Russian actor can play a role as an arbiter. The Russian imperial strategy was in the 19th century this role of arbitration, and it remains today this role of arbitration. But once again, at one point, this might not be possible. Because Europe does want to take any kind of measures, but because the Erdogan regime might not leave any other option to Europe. Or
other option than what?
Than sanctions. Or when you take the Russian case, I think that the Russian administration, the Putin administration, is extremely worried, not only unhappy, worried by the presence of the Syrian jihadists in the Caucasus. They have paid a very high price by the past. They have committed almost a genocide against the Chechens in order to reduce the Chechen rebellions to nothing. They are worried in the Dagestan region. They are worried in the other part of the Russian Caucasus. And to see today that there are 1,200 Syrian jihadists protected by Turkey is something, it is a kind of red line. and this red line maybe tomorrow will not be will be imposed by any kind of measures. I think that we should take into account, just remember what happened with the with the Reverend Brunson.
Yes,
United States, they accepted the situation. They tried to negotiate. They negotiate once, twice, three times, and at the end, that was very slight sanctions. But these very slight sanctions were enough to stop Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
Or in the Rojava in Syria, the Americans, they just threatened Erdogan to investigate his fortune outside Turkey.
Right.
And this was enough.
But yet, as 400 missiles have been tested, and so far, yes, very mild reactions from NATO and Washington.
Because we also observe today a kind of a vacuum in the political arena, in the world of international relations. I said we have already discussed about that. I think that the United States had never, since Andrew Jackson in the 1820s, 1830s, had never such an undetermined, curious, and bizarre administration with no continuity at all in its policies. And of course, the fact that the United States are today in the process, electoral process, leaves also a lot of vacuum. And tomorrow, I think that the main issue might not be necessarily the SS-400, or maybe that will be the case. But at the one, when I say that hubris has to be limited, because you can go very, very, very far away, but at one point, you can be stopped.
Mm.
And the case of Brunson has shown that. The case of the Rojava and the threatening Erdogan by investigating his amount of fortune outside. Here you see that at one point, one leader can say, here you stop.
Mm-hmm.
When this will happen in the future, of course, we do not know. But as I said, the Eastern Mediterranean, because Europe has given so many chances and opportunities to stay, at one point they have to act. When, how, we don't know that. And as I said, even if in the Karabakh region, even if Russia tolerates the Turkish presence as such, probably it will not tolerate the presence of the jihadists.
Mm. Well, let's conclude with the final question, which is full of question marks in itself. Some argue that the more expansive Turkish foreign policy becomes, like, you know, turning almost 360 degrees every week, from Libya to Syria, Syria to Cyprus, Cyprus to Aegean, and then to Caucasus, etc. Some analysts claim that this is basically without any rationale, just to save the day, with the intense focus on domestic policy crisis and economic crisis. Some others argue that there is a rationale and there is an end game, perhaps. And some argued, for example, that yesterday's elections in northern Cyprus, with the open intervention from Ankara, is part of that scheme, that project, and that Erdogan and Bahçeli alliance has a plan, has a wider plan towards 2023, centennial of the Turkish Republic. Is there a rationale in that, or it is just desperately chasing its tail?
I think that we have both elements at once. Mm. The rationale is not 2023, because it's already tomorrow.
Mm.
The rationale is 2071.
Mm.
And Erdogan repeats again and again that Turkey is divided into two camps, the friends of 2071 and the enemies of 2071.
Why? Let's explain for our viewers what 2071 is.
2071 was the first military victory of the Turks against the Byzantine forces.
Entering Anatolia.
And that was, for Erdogan, the beginning of the historical mission of Turkey, of Turkishness. So, by 2071, this historical mission that has been interrupted has to start again, but the condition for this is that the Turkish nation is restored in its ontological purity, erasing the consequences of the westernization, reinforcing itself in internally, morally, and externally, creating a new culture which is at once Turkish and Islamic, and externally to become once again the first dominant power in the region. For Erdogan, the Turks have been created in order to be an empire. An empire cannot be a nation state. That's why for Erdogan, 1923, the Lausanne Treaty is a victory, but just a small victory, a victory in the sense only that it has interrupted the process of decline. But at the same time, this Lausanne Treaty cannot be accepted and will not be accepted. When you are in an imperial perspective, you must go beyond. And when Erdogan reminds us that the homeland, Anavatan, was 18 million square kilometers, and that the Turks find today themselves with a small territory of 780,000 kilometers square kilometers, which makes us still three times in Great Britain. Well, you see clearly what is the violent nostalgia of empire that he feels. But at the same time, I think that the more internal questions, internal issues became impossible to resolve, the more the external front became a way of producing legitimation, being a weight externally in order to use internally. And that's something that you observe. That's a very long tradition, actually. I mean, in the political philosophy, when you take Botero in the 16th century, etc., they clearly say, if you cannot resolve a problem internally, you go out and you create a problem externally.
Mm-hmm. This is what's happening now.
Yeah, Botero asked the question, why do you think that the Roman Empire conducted war twice a year, just in order to not have a problem internally? So I think that internally, the more you have problems, economical problems, the problems of the youth, the integration of the youth, you have 7 or 8 million of young people born after the AKP's arrival to power. So if you cannot resolve these problems, you have to go outside. 2071, you can say that that's a very long perspective. Erdogan will be here, there, here. I will not be there. The question is how you will come to the 2071.
Mm-hmm. No, but if
still 50 years to go. And I think that from that point of view, that's why I say that Erdogan's strategy, Erdogan has no strategy. It may be a goal for 2071, but not concrete strategy. And that's why I think that Erdogan, or at least people around Erdogan, must be a little bit afraid of this hubris, because at one point this hubris can provoke, produce unexpected consequences, unintended consequences.
Such as collapse.
Yes. That's why when you see, for instance, Russian foreign policy, which is a very ambitious policy for Putin too, when you read Putin's discourses, Russian nation has a historical mission. This historical mission is to dominate the world. He explains that. This historical mission is to protect Orthodox Christianity. Putin reminds us also that Russia is a totally different civilization that has nothing to do with the Western civilization. Putin too reminds us that the Russian intelligentsia was corrupted and that the Russian nation has to be restored in its original purity. But at the same time, the Russian foreign policy is an extremely prudent foreign policy. Step-by-step policy, creating alliances, avoiding in many places harsh conflicts. But when you take Turkish foreign policy, you don't have this extremely prudent step-by-step policy.
So if we look to the near future, I think according to your estimation, we will see more and more continued constant steady troubles abroad, beyond Turkey's borders.
Absolutely, and we see that in any case, when you take the post 2009-2010 period, the first conflict with Israel, don't have one single year without a major clash with one country. Just remember the campaigns against Israel. Remember the after what happened in Syria.
Armenia.
Well, in Egypt, with Egypt. Don't forget that a few Koes have been killed in Turkey because they were coming from Holland. A very heavy crisis with Holland. A very heavy crisis with Germany. Erdogan calling, qualifying Merkel as Nazist 10, 20 times, 25 times. Crisis with France. Don't forget the crisis with the United States, with all these people destroying their iPhones or burning their dollars. You don't forget the crisis with Russia, destroying the destruction of the Russian warplane, the crisis with Iran, 2014-2015. So you don't have one single year without a major crisis, and this crisis can last three weeks or 3 months or a little bit more. And thereafter, you have a period of pragmatic consensus, and immediately after, you have another crisis.
Another one coming up. Yes.
I think that one of the reasons is that the Erdogan regime cannot survive without radicalizing itself. And radicalization needs requires crisis. But the second one is also that this hubris. At one point, when he thinks that he is so powerful, that power will be enough to win, and thereafter, immediately, he is obliged to step back. But this step back policy lasts 3 weeks or 3 months, and after you have another crisis. I think that this can be a very good subject for the PhD students.
Yes.
Study the frequencies
of that.
Internally and externally.
But this pattern cannot last forever, can it?
It cannot. Hubris cannot last forever.
I see.
Why, if I could give an advice to Erdogan, is read the ancient Greeks and read Hannah Arendt.
Say again, read?
Read the ancient Greeks and read Hannah Arendt.
Hannah Arendt and ancient Greeks. Okay, let's stop it there. Professor Bozarslan, joining us from Paris, lecturer with School of Advanced Studies in Social Sciences, in short, EHES. Thank you for this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Ahval podcastlerini tüm mobil telefonlarda Spotify, SoundCloud ve Spreaker üzerinden dinleyebilirsiniz. Apple iPhone kullanıcıları bize iTunes üzerinden de ulaşabilir. Türkiye'nin ve hayatın cıvıl cıvıl sesleri Ahval Podcast dizisinde. Kulağınız bizde olsun.